Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are in the world. This is a Design for Living Big Book OA workshop. My name is Val T, and I'm a compulsive overeater and your chairperson today. Today, we're delighted to have both Janet and Melissa joining us from New York. And over the next few hours, they're going to be sharing their experience, strength, and hope in Overeaters Anonymous, focused on the first four chapters of the AA Big Book. To open the workshop, let us have a moment of quiet meditation, followed by the Serenity Prayer in the plural form. God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, courage to change the things we can, and wisdom to know the difference. I'd like to now welcome Melissa to the group. Good evening. And the floor is yours.
Thank you. Good evening. So Janet and I are actually going to share this chapter. So I'm going to do half of it just to kind of give you a heads up, and I'll time myself for half, and I'll invite her to come back in and share for the other half. So there's a solution on page 17. It starts, "We are people who normally would not mix, but there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding, which is indescribably wonderful. We're like the passengers of a great liner. The moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Unlike the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us, but that in and itself would never have held us together as we're now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we've discovered a common solution." So it's the solution that binds us, not the problem, right? "We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree. It's the way out that we agree on, and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism." So what's the great news? Yes, that there's a solution, and that we're permanently bonded to one another through harmonious action. If you remember, earlier when I talked about living a life of isolation to living a life of community. And so part of the solution is living in community, the way we're designed to live. You know, the paragraph talks about friendships that come from being rescued together, but those relationships don't endure once the rescuing is done and the celebration's over, right? But ours continues indefinitely, because to remain rescued, we help in the rescuing of still others. So that's what binds us, right? And that we talked about right in the doctor's opinion. That's part of our rehabilitation, that we continue to work with other people. Our recovery depends on growth of our spiritual condition, which is only sustainable through harmonious action. We're bound together through self-sacrifice and working with others. Those that have been rescued consistently get back in the water and rescue others. In fact, we can't remain rescued unless we do that very thing, right? So we have to help other people. On page 18, it talks about an illness of this sort, as we've come to believe it is an illness, involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him and no one is angry or hurt, but not so with the alcoholic illness, for there goes all annihilation of all the things worthwhile in life. So our disease of compulsive eating rarely, by the way, is even viewed as a disease or even as an addiction. I think our addiction is like undetected, right? Many, many people don't understand that compulsive overeaters suffer from a disease and from an addiction. And we get very little understanding, and we often don't even give it to ourselves. We don't even really, we talk about eating as being bad. Like it's a morality issue. Like I'm being bad right now. Oh, I was so bad. I ate. And if you're sick, you wouldn't claim that you were bad for having symptoms of an illness, right? So, you know, here's the other frustrating thing about this disease is that the sick person, not only does the sick person not really believe that they're sick, but even once knowing they're sick, they have no enthusiasm for the treatment. We're like, we're told, here's a solution. This is really going to work. And, you know, like very often, myself included, I was like, oh, that sounds really hard. I don't want to do that. You know, or I'm like, or I start negotiating. I want to start finding negotiation. That's not enthusiastic about the treatment. You know, we're lectured, we're ridiculed, we're fat shamed. Although I suffered miserably, and so did my family, right? I did not take this problem of mine seriously. Hearing that it's a disease was an important part of the process, although it wasn't enough to be the entire solution. So just finding out you've got a problem isn't enough. Doctors repeatedly attempted to scare me, and my family members, I told you earlier, sat me down and they would give me good talking to's. They would tell me that they were worried and nothing worked, except something obviously did, right? Or I wouldn't be here talking to you today. So what did persuade me? Other compulsive eaters, right? In page 18, it tells us, but the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who's properly armed with facts about himself, that's not fraught the emotional appeal, right? That's I come to you armed with facts about me, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. So we're being given directions really in this part about how to carry the message, how to win the confidence of others. How do we win the confidence of others? First of all, you have to be an ex-problem drinker, not a non-drinker or a problem drinker who's still drinking, right? You can't transmit something you haven't got. When we carry the message, we don't use frothy emotional appeal. We're armed with facts about ourselves. And so we talk about ourselves and our experiences. I don't come to you with facts about morbid obesity. I don't come to you with facts about, you know, diabetes, cholesterol, high blood pressure. Mm-mm. I come to you with facts about me. I'm an expert about me. I can tell you everything about me. And what I find mostly that seems to draw a fellow compulsive overeater in is when I share a story of my own suffering, right? Nothing so much as gets people's attention. Of course, the pictures, they're powerful. But like when I tell people, you know, that I broke toilet seats, like then they're like, okay, wait a second, let me hear what she's got to say. And that's the truth. Or when I tell people that I couldn't sit in the armchairs in my own kitchen because I didn't fit in the armchairs of my own kitchen. Those are the facts I come armed with. And it's what piques interest. It gets the attention of the addict. The next paragraph also tells me precisely how to approach someone, so that the man making the approach has had the same difficulty, that he obviously knows what he's talking about, that his whole deportment shouts at the new prospect that he's a man with a real answer, that he has no attitude of holier than thou, nothing whatever except the sincere desire to be helpful, that there are no fees to pay, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. These are the conditions we found most effective. So what's helpful? The right information delivered from a calm and hopefully humble messenger, right? Good information delivered by someone in a calm, caring manner. People are not convinced when the person carrying the message has a superior attitude or has an axe to grind, meaning a complaint that they must discuss, perhaps an issue with pay and weigh programs or other offshoots of OA. Many of us come to big book workshops having had experience in the other rooms of OA. And if I come here with an axe to grind about other rooms, that's not helpful either, because those other rooms were helpful too, right? And that's not the way we carry the message. So a recovered fellow should have the right demeanor. The way they carry themselves is louder than their words, right? It's the way that they speak. And I love it was said in Bill's story, Ebby showed up bright eyed, right? He looked like someone who had recovery. Page 19 through 20, it says of necessity, there will have to be discussion of matters medical, psychiatric, social, and religious. We're aware that these matters are from their very nature controversial. Nothing will please us so much as to write a book which would contain no basis for contention or argument. We shall do our utmost to achieve that ideal. So remember earlier, what are my ideals? I'm not going to have contention or argument. Most of us sense that real tolerance, that's the ideal, of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions or attitudes, which make us more useful to others. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depends upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. So in recovery, there might be conversations that involve topics that might incite disagreements, debates, and disputes, but our solution means that we're going to proceed carefully in those areas. We don't set out to instigate problems. Why not? Right? Why not? Because it's not useful or helpful. That's why. Our solution has to be useful. It has to be helpful. We're supposed to meet people's needs. We have to be tolerant of shortcomings and viewpoints. And tolerant has a very specific definition. I think about it like if I had a tolerance to a medication or a drug, I'm desensitized to its effects. And that's how I have to be with other people and their shortcomings. I have to have a little thicker skin. I can't be so sensitive. Remember earlier when I said I was like Desdemona and everything would get me all? In recovery, I'm not supposed to be like that. I'm supposed to be pretty calm, to wear, you know, life like a loose garment. You know, our lives depend on this. And I thought my life depended on a good food plan. My life depends on this. You know, so now we're going to look at the different types of drinkers, right? And, or eaters. And on page 20 through 21, it says moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have a good reason for it. They could take it or leave it alone. And then those I would say are people who really don't have a problem at all. They never come to the rooms of Overeaters Anonymous. They gain some weight and they're told, you know, cut it out, eat healthy, frothy emotional appeal probably works for them and they're good. Then there's hard drinkers. And this becomes a little confusing because hard drinkers, they may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may even cause people to die a few years before their time. But if there's strong reason, like ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, these people can stop or moderate, although they might find it difficult and troublesome, and they might even need medical intervention. So I say those are the people who can have success at pay and weigh programs and bariatric surgery. It probably works for people like that. Heavy eaters can have bariatric surgery and it works. They don't need a spiritual program. You know, it's a good option for those people. You can also find people like that at the rooms of Overeaters Anonymous. And they're welcomed here, by the way. Hard eaters are welcomed in OA because the only requirement is a desire to stop eating compulsively. So they're happy to have a seat next to us and they don't need a spiritual solution. They can get well with support and a good food plan. And I always was trying that approach. I wanted that one. I wanted OA light, right? I wanted OA for people who aren't hopeless. But what about the real alcoholic, right? What about someone like me? He might start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker, but at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts. So here we're getting a clearer understanding of what a real compulsive overeater is. And why do I need to know this now? Because I thought we were going to start talking about the solution. Why do I need to know more about this? Well, unless I'm convinced that I'm the real compulsive eater, I likely won't feel the need for the solution, right? That's just the truth. You know, unless you were convinced you had cancer, you're not going to go for chemotherapy, right? And this is sort of like spiritual chemo. So unless you believe you're hopeless, you're not really going to want to do this. The chapter continues to describe the real alcoholic to further help us determine if we truly are in this category. And so it'll talk about why does he behave like this on page 22, right? If hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means debacle, with all its attendant suffering and humiliation, why is it that he takes one drink? Why can't he stay on the water wagon? What has become of the common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? And perhaps there'll never be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. We're not sure why. Once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. So I want to say it's very important if you're here in Overeaters Anonymous hoping to discover the why, right? I've heard that sometimes, like I'm gonna peel away the onion until I find out why. Now I'm all for peeling onions, right? But the solution is not to identify why I do this, other than to say I'm a compulsive eater, that's why. Right? You know, why I became a compulsive eater, I don't know. It says, you know, perhaps we'll never answer the riddle. But I know that there was a period of time when too much of my time and energy was wasted on trying to uncover the why. I really wanted to diagnose and find out why. And what I say is, why is an immature question. You know, when my kids were little, and they would say, I would say, it's time to go to bed. And they would say, why? They don't really want me to explain to them that you need 8 hours of sleep, you know, in order to function properly. Mm-mm. What they were really saying is, I don't like this and I don't want to do it. And that was me with compulsive overeating. When I asked why do I have this problem? I really didn't want the solution. What I wanted was someone to blame. And really, for me, I really wanted to blame my parents, right? I wanted to blame my mother and my father. I wanted to blame society. I wanted to blame the food industry, right? I wanted to blame all sorts of other people, you know? And what I say is, maybe my parents did something. Maybe. I know that they loved me. I believe that my parents have consistently loved me. And they did the best they could, just like me. I do the best I could. And they made lots of mistakes, just like me. And if I did discover the why, unless I'm going to go back in a time machine and undo something, I'm still going to have to do something about it. So we're not going to waste too much time on assigning blame, because that is actually growing a resentment. And that will never be my solution. You know, the why will never really be answered. I can't go back in a time machine. I can't undo the past. So then what? What is the solution? And at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Janet and she'll pick up. I stopped on page 22 after the third paragraph.
Okay. Okay. Hey guys. There is a solution. What a great chapter, right? Even the title, there is a solution, one solution. So I am going to actually skip to page 24 at the very top about something that I referenced before that baffles a lot of people. At a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. So the problem isn't lack of desire. I wanted to stop binging more than anything. I did what I was told. I couldn't stop because, unfortunately, I wasn't told to pick up this book and do what's in this book. I was told lots of different things, but my problem wasn't lack of desire. It was lack of power. And the next paragraph is in italics, which just is code language for, guys, this is really important, so we should all pay attention. So I'm going to read it. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. Well, that is a really dense paragraph there. So let's unpack it, because I think this is key to really taking a first step. In order to take a first step, we need to understand what the insanity is. So normally our defense against doing something dangerous is our memory. For example, we remember that if we put our hand on a hot stove, it will burn us. But if a person had a broken memory and kept putting his hand on a hot stove, we would say that person was insane. What if a person said, well, I had a hard day at the office, so I'm entitled to put my hand on a hot stove, or I just had a fight with my spouse, or I'm mad at my mom or my kids, so I'll just touch a hot stove for a minute, or this time it won't burn me, this time will be different, or my favorite, I'll start refraining from touching hot stoves tomorrow. We would say that that person was insane, but that's how it is with us compulsive eaters. For whatever reason, the mechanism that allows us to remember strongly enough to deter us is broken, and that's the insanity. So a good way to understand this is to think about the connection between our memories and our conscious minds. Right on page 24, it says, we're unable to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of a week or a month ago, and that we're without defense against the first drink. So let's break that down. Normally, my defense against doing something dangerous is my memory. Let's say I'm about to touch a hot stove. So in my memory are stored these data points telling me that touching a hot stove is dangerous. So if I'm about to touch a hot stove, my memory will send a little thought to run across the bridge that connects to my conscious mind and says, stop, danger, hot stoves will burn you. And I don't touch the stove. Or another example, I have terrible cat allergies. So stored in my memory are a bunch of data points of cat-induced asthma attacks. So if I'm tempted to like go into a pet store or visit a friend who has a cat, my memory will send a little thought running across the bridge that connects to my conscious mind saying, stop, danger, cats will give you asthma attacks. So again, my memory keeps me away from danger. Now let's talk food. In college, I used to binge on these certain type of cookies. They would come in a box of 20, and I would always say, I'm just going to have one or two, but I would end up eating the whole box of 20 and sometimes more, to be honest. So in my memory were lots of data points of how I would promise myself I'd eat just one, but I'd end up eating the whole box. So there I'd go again, about to buy a box of cookies, telling myself I'll have just one, and my memory pulls the data to generate a thought to run across the bridge to say, stop, danger. You won't be able to stop at one. You'll eat the whole box. You'll hate yourself. You'll gain weight. Don't do it. Except when it came to food, the bridge was broken and the thought could not get across. My memory failed to keep me in check, and I had no defense against the first compulsive fight. I couldn't keep the memory green. I couldn't just tell myself to stay away from certain foods. When it came to food, my bridge was broken and my will didn't work. Once that bridge is broken, unfortunately, it can never be repaired. So I was hopeless. Just like Bill Wilson, when he realized he was hopeless and said on page 8, "No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. For me, food was my master. I had a broken bridge." Okay, so our bridges are broken. No connection between our memories and our conscious mind when it comes to food. How did it get broken? Melissa talked about that. And there are a couple answers put forth by two different AA doctors. Dr. Bob says that selfishness played an important part in bringing on his alcoholism. Dr. Paul, who wrote the story, Acceptance Was the Answer, said elsewhere that God stamps every 10th baby an alcoholic. So take your pick. Basically what they're saying is, we don't know how we became addicts, but what we do know is that once that bridge between our memories and our conscious mind is broken, it can't be fixed and we're hopeless. But the beautiful thing about this program is as soon as we feel hopeless, the big book gives us hope. And I know we're only going through the first four chapters tonight, but I wanted to give a sneak preview of what's down the road just 60 pages later on page 84, where we find this. "And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, food. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor or food not on our food plan. If tempted, we recoil from it as if from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor or food has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it, miracle. We're not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We've not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky, nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. Now notice the return to sanity is a promise, guaranteed only after we finish the first 9 steps. And look how the big book defines the two parts of sanity. It says, we are seldom interested in liquor, or for us, food not on our food plan. And if tempted, we recoil. We instinctively know that if we put our hand on that hot stove, it will burn us. Not because our memory comes back, that bridge is forever broken, but because by the time we finish the 9 steps, we've built a new bridge to our loving creator. And he personally protects us, right? At the beginning of the chapter, working with others, it says that we have immunity, like a vaccine, we're protected. So back to the book now. And they say, okay, when this sort of thinking is fully established, when there's a broken bridge, there's two, that the person, unless locked up, may die or go permanently insane. He's placed himself beyond human aid. And then at the top of page 25, they tell us our hope, our only hope. But for the grace of God, there would have been thousands more convincing demonstrations. So many want to stop, but can't. Remember, wanting to stop isn't enough. But for the grace of God, that's the solution. What is grace? Unmerited favor. Not because I'm so great, God just better stop watching Netflix and come help me. Unmerited favor. How to access this grace? It says, there is a solution. And then it tells us what we need to do to access grace. Almost like if I'm in a flood and they're telling me that my house is flooding and I need to get to the roof so the helicopter can get me. I need to go up the steps, the 12 steps, if I want to be all symbolic and all that stuff, 12 steps to get to my roof so that the helicopter can rescue me. But I never want to be arrogant to say that I rescued myself just because I climbed to the roof when I was drowning. There is a solution. Almost none of us liked it. So liking it, we're not gonna. Let's just be honest and accept we're not gonna like it all. Self-searching, leveling of our prides, confession of shortcomings, which the process requires. It's not optional. This is all required. But then it says, but we saw it really worked in others. We're to be the miracle for each other. And we'd come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we'd been living it. So then there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. Spiritual tools laid at our feet. And then the promise, glorious promise. We found much of heaven and we've been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. Rocketed, passive voice. And then it tells us what the great fact is, and we should never settle for anything less than this. The great fact is just this and nothing less, nothing less. We've had deep and effective spiritual experiences. What is that? It revolutionizes our whole attitude toward life, other people, and God. Think about a revolution, right? It makes me think of like Les Mis, right? You know, the whole big French Revolution. And here I picture like God send, you know, once we ask God for help, he sends down a team of like these little mini angels with hard hats and tool belts to just come and do a renovation job in our hearts. And what does it say? The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts, God himself entering my heart and lives, enter our hearts and lives in a way that's miraculous and does for us what we could never do for ourselves. And it continues on with the definition of a spiritual experience on page 27, where it says, this is a doctor telling someone what a spiritual experience is. And he says, to me, these occurrences are phenomena, like outside of what we can explain. Huge emotional displacements and rearrangements inside our souls. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding force of the lives of these men, these former alcoholic men, are suddenly cast to one side and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begins to dominate them. We are changed. The way we think is changed. The way we feel, our goals in life changed. Page 28 says, okay, here we are. We in turn sought the same escape with all the desperation of drowning man. So I know if I was a drowning person, I'm not gonna say, you know what? That life preserver is blue and I really like white ones. I'm just gonna take that life preserver. And now it gives us our first clues about God. What seemed at first a flimsy reed, like, well, maybe there's a God, has proved to be the loving and powerful hand of God. God is loving and God is powerful. And we get a design for living, a way we have to live and a way we want to live. And it tells us what we have to do. It says, it doesn't matter your race, creed, or color. We're all kids of a living creator with whom we may form a relationship. Not enough to have a belief. We have to have a relationship. And what's required? We have to be willing and honest enough to try. And again, it promises, and we'll see this in the chapter, We Agnostics, when we try, we get results. So it doesn't matter what religion you are. Doesn't matter if you go to church, synagogue, mosque, anything. It doesn't matter. All you need is a desire to have a relationship with God. On the last page of the chapter, it says, okay, guys, we're going to give you clear-cut directions showing how to recover. And we're going to do it Also, we're going to have 42 stories, and it talks about the stories and what we should always include in our story. Each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. So in our stories, we want to tell enough, you know, at the beginning, so people know we've earned our seat here. We want to tell enough at the end for people to see the difference it's made in our life. But the ballpark of it, the big chunk of it, how did we get our relationship with God? Because that's the solution, right? When I go to the doctor's office, yeah, I may look up and I want to see his degree to know he went to medical school, but I want to know about the treatment that he's given me. That's the bulk of it. I want to know about that. And it says, we hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Yeah, sometimes we have to reveal some not too nice things that we've done in the past, because that makes the other people feel comfortable, that we're not talking to them from a hilltop. Well, yes, I understand because I have 38 degrees. No, I understand because I was eating out of the garbage cans too. And their hope is that many alcoholic, compulsive eating men and women desperately in need. That's our audience, the people desperately in need. If someone says, yeah, I don't really think I need this, great, great. Then we go out and find someone who does. We'll see these pages, and our goal is for them to help. Hopefully they'll say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. I must get this relationship with our creator. There really is a solution. And this book really has a way to find and access God. And people who have these miracles aren't anomalies. Like, this is a promise that we can all share in. And with that, I pass.